My name is Jasmine Johnson. I am 14 years old. Today is November 27, 2019, and I'm speaking with Eric Johnson, who is my father. We are recording this interview in Los Angeles, California. So, what was it like growing up with a priest as a dad?
With a preacher?
With a preacher as a dad.
I was the youngest of five boys, and I think by the time I came around, they had kind of loosened up a little bit. They weren't as strict. So for me, it might not have been the same that my brothers had to go through, but for me, growing up with a preacher as a father, I remember having to go to church every Sunday, which meant going from our house across a little hallway into the big church next door. And I remember that I got to run around and play behind things and poke around and play with things after everyone left. And that was fun for me, getting to see behind the scenes in a church. But I do also remember that a lot of times I didn't pay any attention to what was going on because I had to be there every time. So I spent more time playing with the stuff that was in front of me, which usually meant a big thick book with a bunch of religious stuff in it, like parts of the Bible, and then a lot of songs that we had to sing. And then there was a pencil and a little envelope that you would write down how much money you're donating that day. And I would take those and I would doodle. And I was just sitting in the back doodling. I never really paid attention to what the preacher was saying up on the pulpit, even though it was my father.
What was it like when you told them that you weren't the same religion as them?
They have a hard time with that kind of stuff, and they kind of, what I remember them doing was that sort of, oh, we don't want to listen to this right now kind of idea. And I remember my father's way of dealing with something he didn't like listening to was to sort of grunt or make some kind of noise, like, ugh, rrr, like, these kinds of noises. And my mom would say things like, oh, I don't really want to talk about that right now, or I can't really talk about this, and that kind of thing. And I remember when I said something, it took me a lot of nerve. I had to get up a lot of nerve to say that I had done this, and for me to feel comfortable, I probably even had to say something like, I think I'm a Buddhist, instead of saying, I am a Buddhist. And I remember that they were just sort of in denial and not wanting to really understand or accept it. So to this day, it's just a topic we don't discuss. We let that one go.
Years ago. It's just up in the...
Yeah. It's not something we really talk about.
So, if you could do it all over again, would you raise me differently?
Would I raise you differently if I could do it all over again? I mean, I suppose it would be nice to have more money during all those years I was raising you, so we could do all these things.
Like what?
That we never got to do. Like, go on holidays or, you know, get things, be that kind of... But in reality, I don't think there's anything I would really change. You know? We are who we are. And I think that the experiences we've had are valuable experiences. And you know, I don't think I would... I suppose maybe it would be nice if I wasn't, like, so cranky and frustrated.
I get that from you.
I suppose. Yeah, I could probably calm down and not yell and scream so much.
Well, I think it was better having the amount of money that we did, I guess. Because I might have learned more with the experiences, as you said.
Sometimes I feel that it's I mean, all life is an experience. So, you know, when you... you know, no matter what you do in life, you're going to have stories to tell and you're going to have experiences to look back upon. But I think that being frugal, which means having to, like, save your money and stretch the dollar as long as you can and deal with having the same clothes over and over again until they're just so bad that you have to stop wearing them, it helps you later on in life when times are bad. And that's kind of what we were living through, is like some kind of like some bad times. And, you know, and we learned to deal with it. My parents are older. Your grandparents are older. And they were your age during the Depression, and that's when people had it really rough, and so they learned to save everything and to, you know, make things that you can use later, and, you know, stretch some, you know, a special ingredient gets stretched around different recipes because you only have so much meat. So you make it last as long as you can. And those are values that, you know, a throwaway culture doesn't have. You know, you just buy one, you eat it, and whatever you don't finish, you throw away, you know. And I was raised by people who didn't have that experience. So maybe that's why I see value in being able to save and to reuse resources so that you're not having to constantly buy new things. And that might be a valuable thing for you to have, you know, so you learn to recycle and reuse instead of, you know, throw away when it doesn't suit you anymore. So being that we didn't have lots of money and we couldn't just always buy whatever we wanted meant that we had to just get by with what we had That's probably not a bad thing.
Speaking of money, what kinds of jobs did you have?
What kind of jobs did I have?
Yeah.
I've had lots of different jobs. I've been a taxi driver.
Oh, yeah.
A real taxi, not this modern Uber stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Although I've also been a rideshare driver using my own car. So I've been two kinds of taxi drivers.
Wait, how are those different in your experience?
A taxi driver is usually driving a specific kind of car, a specially made car for taxi driving, and it's owned by somebody else. It's not a taxi driver's car. And it has machinery in it that's designed only for a taxi. So there's this thing they call a meter, and it's when a customer gets in the car in the taxi driver pushes a button on a box and it starts tallying up how much money the ride is costing, and it runs on time and on miles, and it's this thing that sits right there in front of everybody, and it tells you, like, oh, you know, now I'm at $3, now I'm at $7, oh, I'm almost at the end of my ride, and it's going to be, you know, $15.40. And in an Uber, you get into somebody's private car, maybe their family car, and you ride around in something that looks like it could have been your car, and there's no special machinery in it except for a smartphone. And when you're riding in it, you don't notice like a timer going that tells you how long your ride has been, and so they're different in like mechanical ways. They're similar in that a stranger sits in your car and you drive them somewhere, but they're different in how you do it.
But what about your experiences while driving?
My experiences while driving?
Yeah.
I've always felt that as a rideshare driver, because to be in the car, both people, the driver and the passenger, have had to download an app onto their phone and sign in, like sign up and log in with a credit card or a debit card, linking like their bank account to this app on their phone. And that as a driver, I pick up a stranger, we connect through our phones, the phone tells me where to drive, and when I drop them off, the phone takes the money out of their bank account and sends it to the main to the parent company, which then pays me, which is fair and equitable and trustworthy for the most part. But when I was a taxi driver, a stranger would get in my car and they would tell me where they wanted to go, and I would have to figure out in my mind where that location was and the best way to drive there. And I would spend all of my energy trying to figure out how to get to where they wanted to go in the best way possible, safely. And then once we got there, look at this mechanical device on the dashboard and say, you know, that'll be $15.40, please, and hope that this person actually had money and was going to pay me, and even better, was going to give me a tip. But in my experiences as a taxi driver, I found many times people figured out a way to get out of my car without paying me. And sometimes it was a lot of money, a long ride, and they would say something to me like, hold this thing for me while I run inside and get extra money because I didn't bring enough, and I never see them again. Or another good one is, I'm gonna walk my girlfriend to her door, and then you're gonna take me to my apartment. So it's like two stops, and they get out with their girlfriend, walk to the door, and then wave bye-bye and walk into that apartment building and never come back out. And those are ways that, like, they cheated me of paying me for the taxi ride. And in modern times, I don't have to worry about that, because it's going, as soon as I get to the destination and they get out, I can say to my phone, okay, I dropped them off, and the app says, all right, now we're going to take this money out of that person's bank account and feed it through the system and pay you. So that was one nice thing. Another was that there is no safety and sure thing anywhere, but it feels a lot safer to be an Uber driver than it does to be a taxi driver.
Crazy how they take the money like that.
Yeah.
What would you do?
There's really nothing you can do except get really mad and scream and honk and, you know, there's...
He didn't owe the company any money. It doesn't know.
The way you rent a taxi is you pay first and then go out and make money. So I had already paid the taxi company. I just had to return the car in good shape. They would look at it and see if I had any accidents. As long as I returned it pretty much how they gave it to me, then I got to keep all the money that I made while I was driving. So hopefully, if, say, I had to pay $100 to get the taxi for rent, I would hopefully make at least $100 driving. So then I would be even Steven. But if I made, say, $150 or $200, then that $50 or $100 extra would be my profit. But of course, you have to pay for gasoline, and you're out driving for hours on end, and you'd probably stop and get some food somewhere, so your expenses all in all would have to be factored in. And so, you know, if gasoline costs you $30 and you only made $50, then your profit would only be $20.
That sucks.
So yeah, when gasoline is cheap, you're happy. When gasoline is expensive, you're not.
Making $20 as a taxi driver, might as well just work at like McDonald's.
Yeah. The interesting thing about driving a taxi is that you get to meet lots of different people all the time. And sometimes that's interesting and fascinating, and other times it's weird and creepy. And sometimes it's just plain boring. Most of the time, people don't really have any personality. They just want to get where they want to go. They don't want to talk. They don't care. They don't care about you. They just want to go home. Or, you know, they're worried about this person they're going to meet at the restaurant or whatever.
It's sounds like something I do, to be honest.
What?
Like, I want to be the person who's, like, noticeable for, like, a driver to be like, oh, that girl had a lot of personality. But I'd most likely just, like, kind of be quiet and want to go home and not want to.
Yeah. Not want to talk.
Yeah.
Well, it's also hard, like, when you're somewhat introverted to have to drive someone around and actually be friendly and talk to a stranger. That's a little weird, you know. Sometimes it's much more comfortable to just find out where a person is going and just drive them there and not really talk, you know.
Yeah.
So every day's different.
Who's some of the cooler people that you've met?
The cooler people that I've met. I mean, I've met people that seem really fascinated with what I do. And that's a little interesting when someone's, like, super interested in your story. You know, and you feel like, yeah, well, you know, blah, blah, blah. And you end up talking too much. But I've had some people that share my interest, you know, or maybe someone, I remember one time, and this might be boring to someone else, but to me it was kind of funny, but, you know, like a guy who was from out of town going to the airport, so it was a long ride, and he was here for a convention, or a conference, not a convention, and it was a conference at Caltech in Pasadena, and the conference was on, like, something to do with stars or something like that, and I like astronomy and not astrology.
I remember I was thinking of that time when you were talking about the stars, and I was thinking about that word too, like astrology. And I remember Uncle David was saying a story how Caitlin wanted to be an astrologist. And he's like, oh, she's not gonna go far in life. Like, she told, like, he told her that.
Yeah.
And I was like, what's wrong with astrology? Because I thought that was astronomy. And I'm like, oh, I guess I won't be an astronomer.
Yeah.
And then I learned it was, like, something else.
Two totally different
and
things.
And now I get it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a big thing for an astronomer, to have to fight against people who want to call it astrology, or say, oh, you know, you study the stars? I love that. My sign is Pisces, and I, you know, and they're like, no, I mean stars. I'm, like, talking about, you know,
astronomy.
Yeah. I'm talking about supernovas or planetary systems, or, you know, I'm not talking about...
Are you a Pisces?
Am I a Pisces?
No, you're a Gemini.
I'm a Gemini. Yeah.
What about your other jobs?
Other jobs? Oh, I've been a cappuccino jerk.
A cappuccino jerk where?
I was slinging the cappuccinos at a place called Cabaret Voltaire.
That's weird.
It's weird? What's weird?
Cabaret Voltaire.
It's kind of it's something from a different era in Europe in the art world. And also at the time that I did it was the name of a band, but it was in a time before Starbucks had taken over the world, so it was in an era of, it was like the last days of the coffee shop or the coffee house, more like coffee house, where you could find a place that was not a chain, wasn't Dunkin' Donuts, and you could get coffee drinks that were more than just drip coffee, which was what you could get at Dunkin' Donuts or the, you know, the Denny's or whatever, was just drip coffee. This was espresso, which some people called espresso. But you could get espresso, and then if you were fancy, you could get a cappuccino, which basically is an espresso with steamed milk put in it, which isn't really that different than just a coffee with cream.
Normal milk.
Yeah. But this is like steamed, and it gets frothy, and then you put the froth on top of the coffee milk mixture, and it's like fancy. But, you know, we didn't, the most that we would do with flavor was add mocha, which is basically just like powdered chocolate. Yeah. And but you would use the machine that they use at Starbucks, and, you know, something made by Italians, and it, you know, it was interesting. It was good. We met a lot of people that were fun. The place was a fun place. It was cool. Cabaret Voltaire. It wasn't the coolest coffee house in Chicago, but it was pretty cool. What else? I was a bag boy at a supermarket. I was...
Oh, yeah.
I was a... not a bus boy. What do you call them? I was a server.
A waiter?
No, because it was a different... It was the kind of place where you walked up to a counter and placed your order, and then they gave you a number. And then you went and sat down.
You were that person?
So I was the person that brought the food out to you. So that's called a server.
Oh.
Because a waiter...
Waiters, like, take your order.
They go to your table.
And bring you the food.
And usually, not always, sometimes a waiter just takes your order and somebody else brings the food. But
they're like your waiter for the night.
Yeah. But the waiter comes to your table and says, hey, you know, are you doing okay now? Would you like a dessert?
The server just brings out the food.
The server just brings out the food.
What else were you?
So I was a copy boy. Lots of boy jobs.
I had a lot of jobs.
I was a copy boy. That was a good job for a while. I worked in an office. That's where I can say I've worked in an office, had an office job. And, but this was like sort of before the computer age. And, you know, the computers were in the office, but it was mostly to like do taxes and balance budgets and also for writing. You know, and the place I worked at was public relations, so people did a lot of writing, but it wasn't the kind of thing where there was no internet, so it wasn't like you ordered things on the internet and had them delivered to you, or it wasn't like you wanted to do research and you got on the computer and did your research, or it wasn't, in this case, you would want to they would want to find like other examples to cite other examples of this kind of work in their descriptions. And nowadays you would go on the internet and find articles that somebody else had written and say, you know, maybe you would copy and paste from it. This was a time when they wanted to find those articles, and the way to do it was to go to a specific building and give them some information, and they would come back with copies of these newspapers, and then you would bring that back to the office. And then one of my jobs was to cut out the actual newspaper article, like physically cut out just that little piece with just that title, and then glue them with a glue stick onto a piece of paper, and then make photocopies of that. But a lot of times someone would type up their special little news item on their typewriter and pull it out of the typewriter, and then want like 300 copies of that. And so I'd have to make 300 copies, or they would make pages and pages, and I would have to make pages and pages of copies, sometimes 300 copies of a 15-page document. And that's when you learn to collate. And when we got bigger, like we were getting more money as a company, and they moved to a bigger office. Actually, they expanded the office we were in. They made their office bigger, and they got better copiers and bigger copiers, and those could collate for you, which means like you could put in a stack of pages and it would scan one and then scan the other. And as it would spit out 300 copies of page one, it would put it in a thing. And then as you printed out 300 copies of page two, it would put page two underneath page one of every pile. So you would have, like, I don't remember what it was, 50 piles of things with one and two, three and four. Otherwise, the other way to do it was you'd get 300 pages one and 300 pages two, and you'd have to physically go one, one, two, two, three, three, four, four. So that was like the copy boy's job, was to make all those copies. And that was my office job. But what else did I do? I worked in a flower shop where... This flower shop was kind of in a more artsy part of town, and it was very high styled and high volume and lots of foot traffic. People would come in and out all day long, sometimes groups of people, like crowds of people would come through. And also
wait, how have you been adjusting to, like, your job now?
How have I been adjusting to my job now?
Yeah. Like you just told me about your farts, sorry. What?
You want to record this?
Yeah.
What? So, I thought we were talking about flower shop.
Yeah. But I already know that story.
Oh, okay. So, what else do you want to talk about? You want to know how I'm adjusting to my new job?
Yeah, on the same topic of jobs.
The new job is good. I mean, the people seem really nice. And the fact that I'm doing things that I don't fully understand. I am doing things that I don't fully understand, and the fact that the owner of the company and the person that I report to the most are both pretty much understanding, and they don't care that I don't know how to do it. They just know that eventually I will know how to do it. That seems pretty comfortable, and I'm not stressed out about it, you know, because they're not mad at me because I don't know how to do it. That would be stressful if I said I know how to do something and then they throw me a task that I have no idea how to do, and then I have to figure it out on my own, that would be stressful. But luckily, I work with people that are very understanding, and so if someone says, hey, we need to do this and that, and I have to turn around and say, okay, how do I do that? They don't get mad at me. They're like, well, you know, this is what you do first, and blah, 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 blah. And so it's pretty cool. The hard part has been that I was a stay-at-home dad for 9 years and having to do other things on a regular basis that wasn't so strict, you know? So if I needed to go to the grocery store, I could just go to the grocery store. I didn't have to wait until I was done working. So those things are different, and it's a hard adjustment to get used to. I've been there for 3 months, so I think I'm used to it now. But for the first couple weeks, it was really hard to sort out that, you know, I have to go to the post office, and the post office opens after I start work and closes before I finish work. So how do I get to the post office? Whereas in the old days, I just would go to the post office.
How do you go to the post office now?
I have to wait until Saturday.
Oh yeah, you do. I don't have any good follow-up questions.
What's the next question?
Is there anything that you've never told me that you want to tell me now?
Anything that I've never told you that I want to tell you now?
Yeah.
The Vietnam War was a bad war. No, no, I don't know. I can't think of anything.
You're open.
I'm open.
You're open with me, or you just don't want to tell me right now. You want to wait
yeah.
until I'm like...
Yeah, I don't want to tell
six
you
right years now. Older.
6 years?
I don't know.
Maybe 15 years.
15 years? Well...
What else you got?
What else I got? Well, you could tell me about Mommy's family.
Mommy's family?
Yeah, she's from not you, where you're from.
Your mother is from Thailand, and that is a very different place than where we live now in America. And, but your mommy comes from a family, and that's very much like what we have here in America.
Yes, very funny.
She grew up in a family of four, but her mother and father divorced when she was young.
Wait, they did?
Yeah. You didn't know that?
I did not know that.
Yeah.
What the heck? I thought they were together.
No.
Forever.
No.
Oh my gosh.
In fact, your grandfather was married 3 times.
What?
Yeah.
Tell me about this.
Okay, so your grandmother was his first wife, his first love, I guess. Uh-huh. I don't know his deepest stories, but but they met when they were young, mm-hmm. and I think they were from the same village. I'm not sure about that. He comes from a pretty big family. She comes from a big family too, but I think his family was more spread out. He's the one who gives us the Pratumtai name. Your grandfather was the Pratumtai.
Mm-hmm.
At some point, after Mommy was born, he, I guess, met another woman, and fell in love with her, and...
Did he cheat?
Yeah, I think he cheated every time. I think...
Oh, my God.
I mean, I don't honestly know. If I'm remembering my stories right, I mean, I forget a lot of things. I'm older. I forget a lot of stuff. But I think what your mom was telling me was that he cheated on grandma, and he cheated on his second wife. There's one of the three, one of the two later wives was considered like a witch in some ways. Like, mommy's claim is that she put a spell on grandpa and made him fall in love with her and leave his wife. What one it was, I don't know, because I've met the last wife he had, but I'd never met the second wife, and I'm not sure which one it was that's the one who they say put a spell on him. But you know, he had a child with his second wife, and he had a child with his third wife.
So I have half aunts or half uncles?
Yes. Mommy has a stepsister and a stepbrother.
You mean half?
Half, yeah. Half sister and a half brother. Thank you.
I thought he was like, wasn't he loved by everybody in the village though?
He became sort of like he became not a mayor, but like an alderman, kind of like he was political. He became a politician.
And for the small village?
In the village, yeah. And it's a different system than we have here, but somewhat similar. It's a little more communal. But he still had to run for election, mm-hmm. and had to go around and talk to all the people in the village and make them like him and, you know, make promises. I'll take care of you, you know, if you vote for me and stuff like that. And I don't think he was a corrupt person. I think that's why people liked him. I think he was well-liked in his job because he wasn't, like, mean and he wasn't corrupt. And corruption is a big problem in Thailand. And I mean, I'm not saying he never probably did things that we would kind of like raise an eyebrow at. I don't know, but I know that like the people that in the government appreciated him, including like you know, the police officials and other officials in the local regional office, because they all came to his funeral, you know?
Yeah, his funeral was so busy.
Yeah, he had a very big funeral. And that's a good sign that you're a popular person when...
Everybody comes to your funeral.
I mean, like I said, he had a big family. So there were lots of, like, you know, brothers and... you know, nieces and nephews and stuff like that. But there were also lots of people from the village and lots of people from the nearby villages and lots of people that were related to his job came to his funeral. You know, so, yeah.
That's cool.
But, yeah, you have a...
Lying, cheating grandfather.
Yeah, I don't know.
But, like, I can't disrespect him.
No. But, yeah, you have... What I was going to say is that you have a step... You have a half-aunt and a half-uncle.
And second cousins.
And second cousins, yeah.
I think their children would be considered second cousins.
The son is still a young guy. I don't know, maybe he's older now to have like girlfriends and wives, but